Welcome to It's All Politics, faithfully executed by NPR News.
No, I'm sorry.
I'm
John Roberts. Made this mistake. It's not faithfully. You're reading the wrong.
This wording came to us directly from the Chief Justice of the Supreme
Court. I'm sorry.
Okay. Cue the music. Can we get the music? Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, I'm so glad that we had the assistance of our nation's chief judge in putting together today's podcast.
Well, actually, because of budget cuts at NPR, all we can get was Judge Reinhold.
All right. So let's see. What happened this week in politics?
Anything? That's it.
Okay.
That's it for this week.
First off, we must begin with the swearing in of the 44th President of the United States, Barack Hussein Obama.
Barack Obama obviously had some problems with his math. In his inaugural address, he said, 43 people came before me to give the oath. I'm the 44th, but that's not true. Actually, there were only 42 before him.
We're not going to talk about Grover Cleveland serving twice. We're not going to go there. The important thing is he is the first African-American president of the United States, and the important thing is that he brings to an end 8 years of George W. Bush, which he rather actively repudiated even in his inaugural 18-minute speech.
But our time of standing pat, of protecting narrow interests and putting off unpleasant decisions, that time has surely passed.
Except we're doing this podcast on Friday morning, and yet there are still troops in Iraq.
And Afghanistan.
There are still people out of work.
We, I believe, are still in a tailspin as far as the financial industry is concerned. So expectations...
The red line on the metro was delayed 10 minutes today.
Expectations are low or high, Ken? Which way would you swing it?
I think they are high, but given all the problems that are on the new president's plate, I think there is faith in his abilities to get things done. And that's what I think. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what Barack Obama did from day one, making all the calls to the head of the Palestinian Authority, the Prime Minister of Israel, the heads of Egypt and Jordan.
All right. Let's talk very quickly about Inauguration Day itself. Now, the best estimate we seem to be getting from most authorities is 1.8 million people, a little shy of 2 million. Some people had talked about an even larger crowd coming to town. What do we attribute this extraordinary interest to? Is it the state of the nation? It's the personal charisma of Barack Obama? Is it the happiness of anti-Bush elements to see George W. Bush leave office? Why so many people?
It was everything. It was the history involved. It was the unhappiness of the last 8 years. And I think that was considerable from both Democrats and Republicans.
There was a considerable amount of cheering at certain points in the course of the ceremony.
And when they showed President Bush's
helicopter lifting.
Even before that, when they showed his picture on the Jumbotron, there were
boos. It was booing from this crowd. Yeah. Not, of course, from everyone in the crowd or even a very large number, but just audible.
Which was from Dick Cheney.
Mostly just from journalists.
That's right.
It was audible booing from large portions of the crowd, and that's highly unusual.
I think it was just especially the last couple of years, as prices went crazy, as people's financial futures were wiped out, as the war was going on.
You were pinning this more to the economic collapse of the last year or so, perhaps, than to some of the other policies. But most of the things that Barack Obama did as soon as he got his hands on the levers of power had to do with national security issues, interrogation of suspects, closing Guantanamo Bay.
There was a story in the New York Times this week that one of the people who was released from Guantanamo
is now heading up an al-Qaeda faction in Yemen.
Right.
And that is exactly the nightmare, of course, that Dick Cheney and President Bush have been referring to over the last several years when they said, fine, you can close this down, but you're going to have to account for these people and where they may go.
Right.
There were some other steps that he took that did not have to do with national security or did not have to do with the Middle East.
It was lobbying.
There was the lobbying rules, saying nobody's going to serve in my administration if they've been lobbying too recently.
If they leave, they cannot lobby the Obama administration exactly.
That's right.
Okay, and there's some symbolic things. President Obama announced that all staff members making over $100,000 will have their pay freeze in their salary. So it's a shame those poor people who have to make over $100,000 are not going to make any more than $100,000.
Well, they're just going to make what they're making now, whatever that may be.
Yeah.
And he's also reversed the transparency judgment on freedom of information requests under the Freedom of Information Act. Most of the cabinet now has been confirmed.
Right.
Is this not correct?
Right.
But a couple of big ones are still hanging
fire. Mention the ones that have. I mean, Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton. Ray LaHood, your personal favorite.
94-2 was the vote for Hillary Clinton.
And the two who voted against
Jim DeMint and David Vitter.
Right. Of Louisiana and South Carolina, right, making a point. But even the man who had held up the vote from the day before and kept it from being unanimous, John Cornyn, voted for her in the end.
And right after that, John Cornyn went after Timothy Geithner, the nominee for the Secretary of the Treasury. Look, John Cornyn is the incoming chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee. People wonder if this is his role, just to make points, Republican points.
He's supposed to be the attack dog and get himself on Sunday morning talk shows to represent the Republican point of view. So this is a way to get his name in the news. I think that all makes a certain amount of sense. So Geithner's being held up. Eric Holder is also being delayed in his case because there are questions still about some of his activity under the Clinton administration and so forth. But really, they're just holding up, I would say, both Geithner and Holder with the idea of showing that they can.
To make it uncomfortable for them. Look, for Arlen Specter has not asked any new question that he hasn't asked for the last couple of weeks.
And he's the senior Republican on the Senate Judiciary.
Right, and that is of Eric Holder. What was he thinking when he acquiesced in the Clinton pardon of fugitive financier Mark Rich in 2001? And Holder said over and over again, it was a mistake. Had I had more information, I wouldn't have done it. But I think they just want him to sweat. They want Geithner and Holder to sweat a little bit before they're ultimately confirmed.
It seems a bit counterproductive in the case of Geithner, because here's somebody who's supposed to be leading the economic team at a time when the country is tremendously focused on the economy. There are enormous questions about the financial system, and they're holding up Tim Geithner when they know they're not going to ultimately keep him from being the Treasury Secretary.
True, but there's something a little bit unnerving of listening to Geithner say over and over again about the mistakes. I should have known better. It just sounds, for somebody who's going to run such a big, huge...
But this is the only statement he can make.
Right.
If he doesn't just repeat that statement over and over, it's going to turn into a bigger deal than it is now. So we're waiting for somebody to come out and exactly say, I'm going to vote against him because he had a screw up on his taxes.
So I assume within the week we're going to have a full Obama cabinet confirmed by the Senate, warts and all.
And not only a full cabinet, but also a number of people in critical sub-cabinet positions. I thought it was particularly interesting that Hillary Clinton is going to find herself with a cast, if you will, of very strong supporting actors, some of whom are used to being lead actors. Let's talk about George Mitchell as the new special envoy to the Middle East.
Right, and Richard Holbrooke as well.
That's right, Richard Holbrooke. Well, now, George Mitchell was the Senate Majority Leader, and he was involved in the steroid controversy in baseball, trying to get to the bottom of that.
He was supposed to be the next baseball commissioner and next Supreme Court Justice.
And also, he was the guy who tried to bring peace and found a certain measure of success in bringing peace to Northern Ireland. Those are all pretty good qualifications.
This may be tougher.
This may be tougher, of course, but he is also the kind of guy who is used to being, well, let us say the lead dog. And then we've got Richard Holbrooke, who was pretty much seen as the architect of the Dayton Accords that
led to peace in Ohio.
Which led to peace in the Balkans, almost as difficult as finding peace in Ohio. And Richard Holbrooke is also a little bit, let us say, accustomed to being the lead dog and being in charge of anything that he administers or is responsible for. So when you mix in Joe Biden on top of this, you've got quite a lot of lead actors, quite a lot of prima donnas involved in foreign policy.
I suspect that you're not going to hear much from Joe Biden.
Foreign policy?
Exactly. Even though that was his strong point, even though the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I still think with Hillary Clinton and her cast of former Clinton officials and George Mitchell, you may not hear that much of Joe Biden.
So, Hillary Clinton taking over as Secretary of State. Has anyone given any thought to who will get her seat in the Senate?
Well, today is Friday, and just moments before we began this podcast, we heard a very inarticulate Governor David Patterson finally make his choice.
I appoint the senator from this moment on until a special election. There is a special election.
It was Kirsten.
Hold it. Before you say the name. Before you say the name, I think Ken. This is the time for the great, I hate to say this, Ken, you were right. Long before anyone else, weeks, months before anyone else, you were thinking this selection would go to
Kirsten Gillibrand, second-term congresswoman from the Hudson Valley near Albany, upstate New York. In all the bizarro world of Senate appointments, we saw that with Blagojevich and Burris.
Also that crazy appointment out in Colorado.
Michael Bennett.
Who is this guy? Yeah,
God,
go ahead.
So
yeah, go ahead. Kaufman and Delaware.
But Caroline Kennedy, it was the weird thing. From the beginning, she had the name, she had the glamour, she had the celebrity.
She had the name.
She had the name. She didn't have anything else. She didn't have the English language.
I don't think it's fair to say she didn't have anything else. But what didn't have was preparation to deal with what happens when you suddenly say, I'd like to be a United States senator.
It was very bizarre to watch the end of Caroline Kennedy unfold, especially when the rumor was, well, she's maybe pulling out of this, she's withdrawing her name from consideration because her uncle, Ted Kennedy, is not doing well.
Well, and then the rumor that it was a nanny tax payment, you know, IRS type problem, that maybe she'd had somebody working for her that she didn't pay taxes on. Where did that come from? Came from David Patterson's office. Clearly, it came from sources close to the governor.
Well,
so they're trashing her while she's trashing the governor.
Well, if anything's clear about this, it seemed like David Patterson signaled to Caroline Kennedy she would not be the ultimate choice, and so she was allowed to withdraw on her own.
For, quote, personal reasons.
Exactly. But what's interesting, for somebody who wanted to be a United States senator, when she was asked by, you know, the media to explain it, she disappeared. She has not talked to anybody. And, I mean, that's been her way she's been for years. But for somebody who wanted to be a United States senator, I think the public would have deserved a response other than a one-sentence statement, I'm withdrawing my name.
You know, she came out fairly early for Barack Obama back in the early
months, right?
The early months of 2008.
Big endorsement.
It was a big endorsement. It brought in Ted Kennedy. It brought in the Kennedy family mystique. It undercut Hillary in her own home state. And it was a big part of the growing Barack Obama momentum back in the early weeks and months of the primaries.
After the endorsement, then she was part of the vice presidential vetting committee, and she had a public role there. And then she spoke at the Democratic convention in Denver, and it was a public role there. And then campaigned pretty regularly for Obama in some key states. And as you say, she was seen as maybe there's a bigger role for Caroline Kennedy.
And there may still be, but maybe the United States Senate from New York is not the place because of what you have to go through the moment your name comes up. I would submit that if she lived in Colorado and they had decided to give her Ken Salazar's seat, which went to Michael Bennett, she would not have undergone the same kind of brutal grilling that she did in New York, and she might very well have survived and be on her way to the United States Senate today.
As Caroline Kennedy was starting to fade, new polls had come out show that the state attorney general, Andrew Cuomo, was the front runner. His name did not come up in Governor Patterson's decision-making on Friday.
Well, and he had supposedly taken himself out of consideration as a candidate to run against David Patterson in 2010.
Well, see,
he had said, I won't run against
Well, this is very interesting. There was a rumor that one of the reasons David Patterson was thinking of naming Andrew Cuomo to the Senate seat to keep him from challenging him in the 2010 primary, which is so, you don't pick a United States Senator for that reason. Remember, they were talking about Rod Blagojevich, that maybe I'll pick Lisa Madigan, the Attorney General, to be the Senate replacement for Obama so she won't run against me for governor. I don't think people pick people to the Senate for that reason.
Generally, they give it to somebody who they see more as an ally or as somebody who would be on their side as opposed to somebody who's a potential rival.
And that's why I don't think Cuomo was ever a part of that calculation. So it goes to Congresswoman Kirsten Gillibrand. She's photogenic. She's wealthy. She's a good campaigner. She has won a historically Republican seat.
She's arguably moderate in comparison to most of the New York Democratic
delegation. Here's the problem.
She's a gun person.
Well,
she likes guns.
That's a big problem because Carolyn McCarthy, the congresswoman from Long Island who wants
big anti-gun.
Not only is she an anti-gun person, she was a Long Island housewife when her husband was murdered on the Long Island Railroad in 1993 by somebody who had easy access to a handgun.
Mm-hmm.
She ran for Congress for that reason, saying guns are crazy. And so when she heard that Gillibrand was going to be the choice, she said, I'm not going to sit still for this. I mean, that's unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 65 years old, but I'll challenge her in 2010 if I have to. But she is not the person who should represent the Democratic Party and should not represent New York in the Senate. So for all the amount of time that David Patterson had to consider this choice, it could be a problem for the Democratic Party if it's an ugly primary race in 2010.
That's a very real possibility, and that's a Senate seat that the Democrats absolutely feel they have to hold on to if they're going to add to their new margin in 2010.
And speaking of primary battle, you know, Roland Burris is probably, I mean, I suspect that that seat stays Democratic in 2010, but Roland Burris is going to have a tough time in the March 2010 primary.
Yes, he is, because of one person, the person who appointed him, Rod Blagojevich,
right,
who is going very gently into that good night back in Illinois, just quietly suggesting that the only reason they're trying to impeach him is because he would veto a tax increase, and he would be a champion of the people. And Kenny's never been about anything but trying to get health care for children and kids.
Children and kids.
Both.
I mean, who has time to do both? I mean, usually it's one or the other. He actually said, now it sounds like Ron Elving is making a joke, but Blagojevich actually said this in an interview on WLS Radio. He said that the reason they want me out quickly so they could sneakily pass this tax increase, that's just insanity.
That's right. He's going to fight the whole thing, except he's not going to fight impeachment. Okay. If you're going to go ahead and impeach me, I don't think I'll even show up. Why should I show up if I don't get to present witnesses? Well, stay tuned, because there's going to be more about Rod Blagojevich in future podcasts. But for now, that's it for this week's Political Podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm faithfully executing Ken Root.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.